Welcome to Entrepreneurs Unlimited with Mark Haney. Mark is a serial investorpreneur and the chief dreaming officer of the Haney Biz family of companies. With an endless supply of energy, he deploys his experience and passion to unleash the potential in others and share the stories of the region's most influential leaders. And now, here's Mark Haney.
All right. You hanging or banging, Sacramento? If you are hanging, that's cool. Grab a cup of coffee, read the newspaper, relax, all good. But if you are banging, then pull out that pen and paper, get that note taken and going right now, huh? That's what I'm saying, huh? Right? I'm here with Greg Van Duzen, taking the place of my main man, Marcus Haney, today. How you doing, Greg?
Nervous. I don't know if I can fill Marcus's shoes.
They are big shoes, but we are a big man, and I want you are my brother in this entrepreneurial radio show project, the Haney Biz Project, and I think that it's time that our listeners get to know who Greg Van Duzen is. A lot of people know Greg Van Duzen in Sacramento, but a lot of people do not know you yet.
I think if you're under 80, you probably don't know.
Well, Greg Greg's forgot more about Sacramento sports than I'll ever know. And so let's just get a little bit of your background, Greg, and get to know you a little bit before we get our guests on here.
All right. Well, real quick, I started college and I wasn't ready and I didn't do well and I got drafted. I served in Vietnam. Came out, was going to school, and then I saw some guys wanted to bring AAA baseball back to Sacramento after a 13-year absence, and they wanted to play at Hughes Stadium, a football stadium. And so I went down and introduced myself to them at a school board meeting and said, hey, if you're going to do this, you better have a PR guy with a sense of humor, because that's going to be pretty weird.
And that led to you bringing the Sacramento Kings to town from Kansas City, the naming rights at the Arco Arena, and we're going to share those stories later in the show. But I want to share the story right now of how we launched the radio show, because I don't know that it's ever been told before, but you and I were sitting in a room and something happened that allowed us to that prompted your idea to get me a radio show.
Oh, man, it was magic. Kevin Nagel, I wanted to introduce you to some of the major players in the region because they need to know you and know what you're about. And so Kevin Nagel was kind enough to come down to your office, and the three of us were sitting up there in your office, and I introduced you, and then you just started asking him questions. And you were real positive, real inquisitive, and you showed such empathy. And it went on for half an hour without anybody even breathing, I think.
Uh-huh.
And I called time out, and I said, wait a minute, Mark, when did you become Bob Costas?
Uh-huh.
And Nagel says, right? I just told Mark stuff I've never told anybody, and I don't even know him.
Well, I am a curious guy, and Greg, when you said, hey, this is network quality, I kind of looked at you. And the next thing you know, a meeting or two later, you're texting our buddies here at KHDK, Scott Marsh, and I have an entrepreneurial radio show, and this is the Haney Biz Project. And today we're going to be talking about multi-generational grit. We have the Kovar men coming on the show today, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We have Dave Kovar, who's built this empire around martial arts. But his father, Lenny Kovar, is a prisoner of war veteran from World War II, and we're going to share that story and what happens when the pain and suffering of one generation and the lessons that are learned through that are passed down to that next generation. So later in the show, we're going to speak with Len Kovar. He is that World War II veteran. He was the German prisoner of war, and we'll hear his incredible story. But after the break, we will meet Dave Kovar, the entrepreneur. Dave got his start in martial arts at an early age. He's built one of the most respected martial arts businesses in the country. Kovar Satori School of Martial Arts is based right here in Sacramento. Join the conversation on Facebook Live. Yes, this is Entrepreneurs Unlimited, and we'll be back in just a minute.
And now, back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited with the Entrepreneurs Advocate, Mark Haney.
Welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited, presented by Five Star Bank, the Entrepreneurs Bank. I'm Mark Haney, And today I am joined by Dave Kovar, the founder of Kovar's Satori School of Martial Arts. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing excellent. Glad to be here today.
Thank you for being here. Now, I want to, for anybody out there who doesn't know about Kovar's, give us an overview of the organization, if you don't mind.
So we started in 1978, about 6 months out of high school. I opened up a school in North Highlands, and I just didn't have a clue what I was doing. I still only half know what I'm doing, but the mistakes.
It's worked out okay.
It's worked out okay, yeah. And we just kind of, you know, I got into this not because I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to teach. I loved martial arts, and that was the only way to do it. And so we struggled through the 80s, and in October of 1987, my older brother Tim came on as my partner, and we just kind of blew up. And so blew up meaning we gradually went from one location to, you know, when he came on board, I think we had a couple hundred students to now we have 9 in the Valley, and we have about 3,500 members, and real proud of our team. Got an amazing group of instructors that have been with us a really long time, and we're really committed to, really, for me, martial arts is you know, we teach kicking and punching, but it's about molding people's lives, especially the kids. We work with adults as well to kind of a better future.
Well, when our listenership found out you were coming on the show, I don't know how many comments were sent to me about the respect that they have for Kovar's and the training that they've got in Kovar's over the years. You've shaped so many people's lives. Do you have any idea of how many you've shaped?
So I think we've had probably upwards of 28,000 people actually come through one of our schools, and we've promoted over 3,000 black belts through the years.
Wow.
Yeah, I know it's in hindsight, it sounds... I'm very proud of what we've accomplished, but we're really just getting started. So there's so much more to do. And what we kind of look at it is what makes martial arts unique and different maybe than other activities. There's whatever works for somebody to be able to pour their spirit that's positive is a good thing. You know,
yeah.
The X factor for martial arts is the fact that because of the nature of what we're teaching could be determined as violent, right? We're teaching kids to hit and kick and punch. It really obligates instructors to teach the other side respect, courtesy, self-control, especially.
Yeah.
And that's the great balance. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
mm-hmm.
And so kids hear stuff that they might not otherwise hear, you know, about being polite and courteous and, you know, et cetera.
Well, how much does being trained in martial arts, and especially as you move up through the ranks, how much does that affect your self-confidence?
Oh, it's amazing. If you do it right, by the way, you can have a bad experience, as you know, as we all had maybe as kids, where we tried something for the first time and we failed miserably and we say, not for me.
Yeah.
Right?
How'd you know that?
Because it happened to me a lot. I figured it had to at least happen to you to one time.
It still happens about every day.
Yeah, so. I get it. But we still get up, right?
Yes.
And so what happens is what we've kind of really tried to structure our program is the beginning. You know, we have a concept called the confidence spiral. And I want you to imagine these two words, failure and low confidence. You can see how those are related. If I fail at something, my confidence goes down.
Okay.
If my confidence goes down, I'm more likely to fail. We see it in sports all the time when someone's going through a slump.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side is when I'm successful at something, my confidence goes up. When my confidence is higher, I'm more likely to be successful. It can't be false confidence, but that's almost an oxymoron in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so what happens is we make sure students, when they first come in, they experience success. We set them up for success, and then the challenges get harder as they're ready for them. It's kind of like we don't throw someone in the deep end of the pool and say, swim.
Right.
We kind of ease them into things.
Now, as entrepreneurs, we have that same sort of dichotomy, I suppose. We need to get in the game, and sometimes it's scary, but when we start to get our confidence, that's when things really fly. When did that happen for Kovar's?
So, you know, I think the first several years, as a matter of fact, interesting, my older brother was my business partner, as I'd mentioned, Tim, and was with me for 20 years. And my whole family, including my father, who you guys will meet in a little while, when I first opened a school, was, hey, come on, man, get a real job. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of thought that, too.
He didn't think, my son's an entrepreneur, that's what I've always wanted
no,
for him?
No, no, no. It was like, you know, what are you doing? You know, okay, it's just a phase. He'll get through it.
Yeah, kung fu fighting, right?
Exactly,
like, come on,
totally.
Man.
And my older brother would tell you the same thing. He was saying, "All right, Dave, you know, you can do this through college, but then you got to get a real job." And then finally, you know, we just kind of kept plugging away. And then it was like, I know when my brother came, tried to check it out, I go, "Wow, this is really something." You know, it's we can certainly make a business out of this, but at the same time, we can have a really positive impact, which is kind of a win-win, right?
Yeah.
And so that's probably, it kind of hit me, a quick story so I had this gal, her first name was Shanti, that trained with me when I first opened up a school. She was probably about 10 years old. She trained with me for a year. And that was the last, you know, so they moved away. And about 10, 15 years later, the father called me up on the phone, and his name was Fred. And he goes, "Hey, sir, you know, I hope you're doing well. My daughter Shanti trained with you a decade ago, and I just want to let you know." He was calling because they had moved, and he had a younger son. He wanted to get involved in martial arts, wanted to know if I could recommend someone in the town they lived in. And then he said, "You know, that year that Shanti spent with you was the most powerful year." And I'm not talking about the kicks and punches. It was like he used the word like life skills, right? And I thought, "Oh, thank you." I hung up the phone. But then I thought, at the time, we really didn't teach any life skills. It was just about the hardcore stuff. And by that time, we'd already been really emphasizing a message of the week and courtesy. And so that's when it hit me, the impact that we can have going forward when we really stress all this stuff and not just hope it happens, but do it on purpose. Yeah. That's when I think I really got confident in what we were doing.
When you get that proof that your concept really does work,
yes.
It makes an impact. Sometimes that's when you hear it from a customer.
Yes.
You may have heard it from a child. Now, thinking about coaching young people, how much involvement does a parent typically have?
So in our program, we obviously parents are the key. They're so to a successful child when it comes to them, their support of our program, right? In other words, someone's got to drive them there and pick them up and encourage them to practice when they don't want to and encourage them to go when they don't feel like it, because that's something everybody goes through. Once they're there, you know, we like to take the ball, meaning we don't really like the parents on the sidelines barking out stuff, which is nature. Hey, I'm a dad. I get it. But so we program everybody when they first come in. Hey, it's great for you to practice at home. When you come to the dojo, when you come to the martial arts school, then that's our job. If you can you sit on the sidelines and not be basically a distraction
is
for the instructors.
Is it okay for a child to feel a little bit of discomfort? I mean, is that
yeah, of course that's the yeah absolutely. And just I think we're going to go ahead and just kind of we're off Facebook Live on our page now, so hopefully they're on the other one. Good.
Okay. Good. So you've had the, it sounds like there's been some impactful moments. Your brother coming on helped grow the business. You've got some proof of concept. You've really scaled this. You have a lot of locations and you do a lot, you do speaking all over the world. What challenges have you had in building this business?
There's lots of challenges in any business, and they're ongoing. It's not like you ever arrived. It's not like, wow, you're successful,
yeah.
Mark.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of fleeting. Try treating all your people that you know like crap and making a few bad decisions. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like it's ongoing. It's like every day, get up, you know?
Get up.
And, what does Wayne Gretzky say? You miss 100% of the shots you don't take, right?
Exactly.
And so the deal is you got to try stuff and know that it's not always going to work. And what's interesting that I see, you know, like a baseball analogy, you know, it's not three strikes, you're out. In the real world, you can keep swinging. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so we've successfully identified a lot of things that don't work. How's that? You know, but it's just a matter of, okay, trying to learn from experience, you know, and try not to repeat the same mistakes over. And then it's really the balance between intelligence and common sense and emotion. What I mean by that is sometimes our emotion will get us to do something that maybe isn't the best choice. So it's kind of like, actually, once again, my older brother would use the white socks theory. And white socks theory is how excited you get when you go to the store to buy white socks. Pretty neutral.
Yeah.
So that's how you should be looking at any endeavor, is like, don't let your emotion get you to be so excited you don't use logic in making your decisions. How many times have I thought, oh, there's problems, but I can do it? And you step into something that you didn't think out thoroughly. So it's like tempering, your emotion with really clear thinking to where, you make wiser decisions. You make less mistakes.
Now, Dave, you're a purpose-driven guy, right? You see the bigger picture in life and the why. What purpose drives your business?
So, you know, I years ago came up with a mission statement, and it is my purpose. It is to globally empower people of all ages to be more confident, healthy, happy, and contributing members of society through high-quality martial arts instruction, which consists of training in self-defense, health, fitness, and life skills. That's it. So that was, to help other people through what we do, I guess, would be the easy version.
Yeah, yeah. And how much did your dad inspire you?
Oh, massive, massive. Yeah, he's been an amazing role model. I people talk about growing up in dysfunctional families. I had probably the most functional family that you could be. You know, both my folks are, by the way, still alive. I'm blessed, squared away, great role models. I have plenty of stories of my dad when maybe he was angry with us for something, which is very rare, but every father has a right to be. But massive amounts of stories of him just being a great example. Here's one for you. So we're at the movie theater. I'm probably about 14, maybe 15. I was very small for my age. and we're getting ready to play tickets. And I tell my dad, "Hey, Dad, you know, if you tell them I'm 12 years old, you can get in for cheaper." And it made sense to me. Save some money. And my dad looked at me and said, "My honesty is worth more important than a 50-cent discount."
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that was one of those ones that really man, it was powerful.
Well, we're about to meet your dad, and when we return, we're going to get a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to meet Len Kovar. He is a true war hero. Join the conversation on Facebook Live. This is Entrepreneurs Unlimited, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited with Haney Biz's Mark Haney.
All right, and welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited, presented by Five Star Bank, the Entrepreneurs Bank. And today I am joined by Dave Kovar and his father, Len Kovar. Len is a veteran of World War II, and on his 11th mission as a navigator bombardier, Len was shot down, captured, and you became a German prisoner of war. Tell us, we're here to hear your incredible story. What happened? I'm picturing a dogfight. What happened?
Well, what happened on the dogfight? Well, we were flying number 4 position of the Air Force. And by the way, to look back and see literally hundreds of airplanes in formation, an awesome sight. It'll never be seen again. But we were approaching the city of Budapest. And by the way, when you bomb, you'd come in, the first wave would come in and drop from the north. The next one would go about 10 degrees around the circle. And this would go for maybe 50, or maybe not that many, but anyway, quite a few runs would go across the city, each plane dropping bombs as it went.
Wow.
Quite a thing to see. Anyway, I was on my 11th mission. We were flying on number 4 position, and we were heading in on the target when we got hit by enemy fighters.
Oh, wow.
Squadron of FW-190 German fighters took on our escort, and another squadron took on us. And there was, there were 30 airplanes scrambling and whirling around. And
you were dodging and diving and bullets flying all over the place.
Something like that, right. And then suddenly somebody hollered, "We're on fire." And with that, I hollered back through my intercom, "Should I open bomb bays?" Because that was the escape hatch for the rest of the crew. Somebody screamed, "Yes, for God's sakes, open them." So I pulled the handle, and I could feel the airplane begin to shudder and so forth when the doors opened up. And the other guys began to bail out. And as they did that, I reached up into the nose wheel, which was right up, nose gunner who was right above me, reached up and opened the doors of his hatch. And he jumped out and darned near knocked me down. I clipped on my own parachute and opened the doors, our escape hatch, which was the nose wheel doors. And the last gasp of hydraulic fluid was there, and they just opened the doors. And I looked down, and I remember thinking, "I wonder if I'm afraid."
Did you ever discover that?
I think I was. Anyway, I looked down, and there was space out there, and I bailed out, jumped out of the airplane. We were at 27,000 feet at that particular point. And I remember a German fighter whizzed by me, big dogfight going on. One of the biggest dogfights of the war, so I understand.
So you're dropping from the plane. Right. Your parachute hasn't opened up yet. You're just dropping, free-falling at that point.
That's right. And airplanes are whizzing about. There's a big dogfight going on while the bombers were in process. Uh-huh.
So you want to drop quick at that point. This is not the time you want to open your parachute and go down slow motion.
That's
you want
right.
to wait till you get closer to the ground.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you want to get out of the fighting.
Yeah. Okay.
Know? So I pull my ripcord, and the parachute opened and blossomed open, And by then I would probably was at, oh, I don't know, I suppose 18,000 feet or something like that. Fairly
still high, yeah.
Yeah, pretty high as yet. And, well, anyway, then.
So that was a long, slow ride down to the ground. That must have been, that may be when some fear started to kick in.
Actually, there was a period of time in the middle of that drop when I had a sense of quiet, a sense of presence, a sense of peace that was very, very special and very, very profound. And anyway, I was held in the embrace of a warmth that has no beginning and no end. It was very, very special. That's right.
And then was there a point in time when you got closer to the ground where you started planning what the heck you were going to do?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the question is, what do I do at this point? Now, obviously, I'm 500 miles behind enemy lines, and I didn't want to get caught, of course. And I looked down to look for a place that I could maybe land. Maybe I could find a way to land in the woods. And I looked around, and there was a patch of wood. It looked to me like it was about 6 blocks square. Turned out that it was much larger than that. But it was an area of wooded, and I pulled my ripcords, my parachute, and jockeyed it around so I went toward the woods. Finally got over the woods, and I dropped into the wood, and my parachute, well, I dropped through the trees into this forest, this heavy forest, and my parachute hung up in the top branches, and I bounced a couple of times.
You bounced, not on the ground, but you kind of suspended.
And I ended up about a foot off the ground.
Oh.
Hanging there about a foot off the ground.
Were you stuck there, or could you climb out of that?
Well, I bounced up and down so that on the lower bounce, when my feet hit the ground, I was weighted. And therefore, during that half second, I could unhook my parachute and drop out.
And you weren't injured. You were healthy at that point.
Oh, I was 20 years old, strong and healthy. I mean, you bet.
Okay, so what happened? Now you're in behind enemy lines. Got to be scared, but you got to find a way to get yourself to some kind of secure area or safety. I don't even know what that looks like.
Yeah, well, I dropped into the trees and my canopy got caught in the top branches up above, and I hit the ground with my foot and kind of twisted an ankle and then bounced a couple times. And when it stopped, I was about a foot off the ground.
Yeah. Did you, now, when you got out, did you make a run for it? What happened?
Yeah, well, I managed to bounce my parachute so that my feet were on the ground momentarily, and I unhooked my parachute.
So, Pop, once you got out, you were. He knew some people. He'd recognized some people that were coming his direction. So what he did is instead of going away from them, he went into them at an angle.
He hid
in the bushes, basically, as they ran by.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I ran about 45 degrees from toward them. I found a bush, and I crawled under the bush, and tucked in my feet, and just lay there and waited while this small group of people came in and began to search the area. And they thought that I had gone a different place, so they left after a while.
And how long before you were captured? What happened approaching when you were captured?
Well, it was a couple of days. I was free for a day or so, and until finally I did a stupid thing and got myself captured.
What'd you do?
What happened was he was dehydrated and he needed water, and there was a local town he snuck into actually one time, and he got water out of the well, and he went back to his hiding place in a corn patch, and he was getting all situated, but he put his water bottle, it fell, and he lost all his water, right?
Yeah.
And then he had to go back, and then I'm just going to get you started. You take over the story. A bunch of dogs were barking, and next thing you know, some locals came and escorted him to the local authorities.
Yeah, that's right.
And then so they took you ended up being in a stalag. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but there was after quite a bit, a bunch of stuff happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, no, Pop, tell them about the time. So you were met up with your buddy, and you now were getting transported to a Stalag, and he was being watched by a young soldier. And then there was the crowd came around, and they were very violent, and you actually recited a poem that kept him quiet that you think saved your life.
Yeah, there was a number of little incidents, one of which was in a train station, and the people were very angry and malevolent.
Keep in mind that this is a bombardier that had been bombing their cities, and
right.
He's also Hungarian. Our name Kovar is Hungarian. We're in that area, so like a traitor almost.
Was considered a traitor to the cause because I was not on their side. Anyway, I was in this little village after I was shot down. I was very thirsty and I was dehydrated.
So, Pop, tell them about when you're at the village when you started to the cremation the shooting of Dan McGrew. Tell them a little bit about how that went down.
Yeah, that was when I was in this little village, and I wanted water, and I found that I saw an open well. I went in and tried to get water, and as I did, people saw me, and so they came up toward me, and I started trying to walk away. The bottom line is that I ended up in a building, kind of like a community center of some sort, and where a bunch of townspeople came up and they began to interrogate me and that kind of thing. I remember there was a woman, a big, heavy woman, who came in and brought me some water, which I very desperately wanted, and also a couple of pieces of green pepper. For something to eat.
Yeah.
And I sat there in this room for quite a while they, a panel of about a half a dozen men sat there debating what to do with me. And that was a pretty tense period.
And then he has a poem that he still can recite. It's called The Shooting of Dan McGrew. It's by Robert W. Service. And it was something that you did in high school, and it was his favorite one. And he's with his friend, with his buddy, another guy that he'd hooked up with, and that this crowd is starting to turn into like they're like a lynch mob.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And every time, Pop noticed, every time he would talk to his friend, they would all shut up. So he goes, okay. So he started reciting give him the opening line of the shooting of Dan McGrew, Pop.
A bunch of the boys were whooping it up in the Malamute Saloon. The kid that handled the music box was hitting a jack-time tune. Back of the bar in a solo game sat dangerous Dan McGrew. And watching his luck was his late love, the lady that's known
so
as...
It's actually like a five-minute long poem. It's amazing. He can still say the whole thing. But that got him through that moment.
When you spoke, that quieted the crowd.
That's right.
So now, you know, a bunch of trains later, he ends up... Was it Stalag 3 first, Pop? Was that the one you were in first?
Well, that was the main camp.
And that's the one that the Great Escape had just happened a few months prior, you know, the famous movie based on a real story. That was the Stalag that he moved into.
Tell us what it was like there. We want to know what it was like in Stalag 3.
Well, Stalag 3 was a steady place in the sense that the German guards were there. We got fed one meal a day, come to think of it. But it was a steady place to be, and I was in that for about 3 months. It was not a very happy place, of course. The German guards were around us all most of the time. But when the Russians made their drive from Warsaw to Berlin, we were in the path. And when the artillery and so forth began to be visible off in the distance, the Germans wanted to keep us as hostages. So they marched us ahead of the fighting. Just as the worst storm, I understand, the worst winter storm ever recorded up to that point began to settle in. And we started a big march, and it was really a beaner of a march.
And in the process of the march, at one point you had boots that didn't fit you right, and which is a real issue when it's 40 below zero.
Yeah.
And at a stop, you're getting some warm bread, and you reach down and you find a bag full of wool socks.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah,
It was like all of a sudden, you know, prayer answered.
That makes you believe in something higher, in a, with a higher power, doesn't
something
it?
Something like that.
Yes.
Right. You betcha.
And so then also he ended up with, he ate some a can of that had been open of corned beef hash, and he ended up getting food poisoning, and his buddies had to leave him in a barn and keep moving with the butcher, and they basically left him. Fortunately, a day later, some other people came across you and woke you up and kind of got you back onto the march.
Yeah, that's true. You're thinking of an incident of the second march.
Okay.
We made two marches. The first was when the Russians made their drive on Berlin, they marched us ahead of them. And it was, the fighting was going on behind us, and it was a very difficult march. We started with 2,000 men, and I don't even want to tell you what we ended with. I hardly believe it myself. We lost many, many men.
So these are prisoners marching from one Stalag to another?
That is correct. See, the Germans wanted to keep us as hostages. They wanted to use us as bargaining chips.
Mm-hmm.
And they.
What was, besides that, those marches and that weather and the pain associated with that, what was the most terrible thing about being in those Stalags?
What was the worst thing? Well, it depends on where you were. I was in three camps, and the first camp was tolerable in many ways, but the second and third was something different. That was a different thing. Our stay in Nuremberg, my stay in Nuremberg was about as miserable as you can get. The camp that we were in had been used before by many other prisoners, and it was just almost alive with vermin, with lice and that kind of thing. And I remember that was, I remember my blanket. I had a blanket, and on my blanket there were white streaks, which was the vermin that was inhabiting mm-hmm. them with us. It was mm-hmm. pretty crummy.
And then in terms of, because where this is AM radio, we don't have, I could talk to you all day on this stuff, but so when you were released, right, George Patton was the man at the helm at that time. Tell us about what happened when you were released and what that must have felt like.
Pop, just talk about when they first, the flag, when you saw the American flag.
I remember. This was the third camp I was in now at this point, and we knew that the war was close to coming to an end, and Patton and his troops were coming close, and the fighting was right with us, so to speak. And at one point, the firing began to ease off a little bit, and everything began to be a little quiet as the I remember lying in this slit trench, this foxhole that I had, and things got quiet, and I knew that the Americans were close, and they got real quiet, and I sucked my head out and looked around a little bit, and everything seemed quiet, so I stood up a little bit, looked across the way, and there was I looked at the flagpole in the place, and I stood up just in time to see the German flag, the Nazi swastika being drawn down.
Oh,
I stood
gosh.
There for a moment, and then another flag came rolling up. It was the Stars and Stripes.
Wow.
That was probably the most dramatic moment of my life. I stood there filthy, dirty, crawling with lice and so forth, and I remember standing there and saluting my flag. And it was a very, very moving tense moment. Yeah.
Len, anybody listening to this story, if you're not a proud American right now, listening to this, being in the room with you today, unbelievable. Words don't really do it justice. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your story today, Len. Obviously, you've raised one heck of a family. You've lived an extraordinary life beyond World War II. I'm so proud to be in your presence at this moment.
Well, I appreciate your thought. Thank you.
Len Kovar, along with his son Dave, sharing very touching story about America and what Americans are all about. When we return, we'll be back with Greg Van Dusen, the Vietnam veteran and a man with some great stories of his own. This is Entrepreneurs Unlimited, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited with Haney Biz Investorpreneur Mark Haney.
Welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited, presented by Five Star Bank, the Entrepreneurs Bank. And we are bouncing back from probably as riveting of a conversation as I can remember, certainly on this show, but even in my lifetime. I'm here with Greg Van Dusen, my strategic advisor, the man who oversees this show. And Greg, what goes through your mind? You sat and listened to this with me. What goes through your mind?
I thought that was amazing.
Sorry, let me get your mic on there.
Hey, there we go. I thought that was so amazing. Yeah. You know, my family came over here on the Mayflower. I'm an 11th generation born here American. We've served in every war in our nation's history. And I listen to Len Kovar, and I think about, that's the spirit of America, willing to sacrifice, willing to put it all out there. It's the patriotic spirit. It's the entrepreneurial spirit. It's what gets you across the goal line. That's America. And I think about these snowflakes on the college campuses, and somebody said something that made them not feel good, and they got to go take a nap.
Yeah.
Are you real? Yeah. Think about the sacrifice that people have put forward in this nation to make us what we are.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're working on a revolution of our own right here in Sacramento, trying to inspire entrepreneurship. You know, what can we do at home, on the home front? How do we show our patriotism here? You know, you do what you can do. You look around, you're like, you do what you can do. Now, you, Greg, have done some amazing things. I mean, you're a Vietnam veteran, but I want to talk. I think a lot of people are curious about when the Kings originally came here from Kansas City. What happened during that period? That was obviously some risk was taken, some effort was put out for the good of Sacramento. What happened?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be the first employee of a group called the Sacramento Sports Association, pardon me, headed by Greg Lucanbill and Joe Benvenuti and Fred Anderson. And they wanted to bring Major League Sports to Sacramento, and everybody looked at us like we were crazy. And we were. You got to be a little bit crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so we weren't getting any traction, and we went all over the country with a group of leaders from Sacramento, business leaders. And the media came with us, and we talked to people in other cities, like talked to John Nordstrom in Seattle and talked to Bob Breitbart in San Diego. And then eventually we went to New York and talked to all the league offices. And the consensus was, you know, you're stupid. You're not going to get a baseball team. Get a basketball team, because the NBA was failing at that time.
Oh, gotcha.
So first we negotiated with Indiana and didn't make it. Then as a result of that, we negotiated with the Kansas City Kings, made that deal for $10.5 million.
Now, when you say made that deal, the Lucanbills and the group bought the Kings for $10.5 million.
Oh yeah, plus $1 million in depreciation.
And now it's worth over $1 billion, is what I'm hearing.
Pretty good equity growth.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice growth, nice return, and it has been great for Sacramento.
Put us on the map, you know, and it made us a major league city. It's led to so many things, in terms of credibility, and now it's leading to more. Now that we have the new arena downtown. But, you know, Arco Arena was the first naming rights deal ever. We weren't popular in the NBA because the government, the public sector, did not put a penny into the development of either the temporary or the second Arco Arena. It was all private, even the interchanges.
So you got the money by going to Arco and saying, hey, how would you like to put your name on the outside of this big, gigantic building?
Yeah, we had to develop new revenue streams.
Yeah.
And so basically naming rights is a sponsorship on steroids.
And you were the guy.
Yeah. Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes, you know? Yes. Now, in terms of that, now with what happened, I mean, looking around the sports, what's happened within sports, everybody's doing that now.
Yeah, I know. I didn't.
People are copying your idea.
I don't get residuals.
Okay, so let's talk about your Uncle Jim. I know he is a story that is close to your heart.
Well, somehow my Uncle Jim and Len Kovar must be buddies somewhere. My Uncle Jim was in World War II. I got to get this right. He commanded the 3rd Infantry Battalion in the in the 385th Infantry, the 76th Division.
Okay.
And they went through France chasing Nazis all the way through France and chased them into Germany. For all I know, that might have been the unit that was with Patton there. But mm-hmm. at one point, they came upon a minefield, and Uncle Jim was the commander of his unit, and he ordered them to halt. And he got down on his hands and knees for 36 hours, and with his bayonet, he dug out all the mines for about a mile so that they could move through so that the armored division following them could come through. Because World War II, there was a lot of tanks on both sides.
Yeah.
And so as a result, he got the Silver Star, a Bronze Star with two clusters, the French highest medal they can give, which is the Croix de Guerre.
Such bravery.
Yeah, and that's America. That's entrepreneurship. I mean, that's the whole thing. That's what you do. You know, when you learn, you know, in war, I mean, look at these snowflakes again, you know. There's really two kinds of people in this world. When people are trying to kill you, you figure this out. There's people who will save your life and people who will get you killed.
Yeah.
You better figure out who you want to be standing next to.
And we've been talking about generational grit. You said that your ancestors came over on the Mayflower way back then. You know, before the Pilgrims, and obviously there was such a struggle. It took such bravery for that initial group of people to come over here, and the different battles and wars that had been fought all the way up to your Uncle Jim and then you in Vietnam. How much does that legacy of your ancestry affect who you are deep down inside, you think?
It's everything. And I think I first realized it when I was about 10 years old. My grandmother was an officer in the National Daughters of the American Revolution. And she took me to a convention in Denver, and then I figured it out. And so when it was my turn, I went. I have two sons who served. One is still in the reserves as a major in the Army. And it's what we do. We love this nation. We love the spirit. We love business and the private sector. And so that's why it's so great to see what you're doing here, becoming a voice for the private sector and for entrepreneurship, because, you know, we got all these young men and women away in the military right now, and it's going to be more soon. What are they going to do when they get back? We better develop some jobs, and that's going to come from the entrepreneurship that's going on in Sacramento right now.
You are right on track, Greg. I want to thank you for filling in as my co-host today. Very inspiring, and I look forward to doing. I've been working on this for almost 2 years now, and I finally got you on the show today. And I want to thank you for coming on. I also wanted to take a minute to thank Dave Kovar and his father Len. Really, a once in a lifetime opportunity for all of us to sit in that presence and to hear that story to that detail. So many people of that generation and of any generation are so reluctant to talk about the hardship that exists in a time of war. So thank you, Greg. And I got a couple little shout outs here to some friends. Jordan Darling will be out at Sacramento Boat Show at this new electric jet ski, first one ever on the market. You know, Jordan's a great story. He's an entrepreneur right here in Sacramento. I happen to be invested in Freeform personally. He's going to be out there showing off his new electric jet ski. So get out there and take a look. And a little personal shout out as well to my friends. It's tax time right now. And, you know, when it's tax time, you need to be thinking about having the right accountant on your side. And there is nobody better than Jason Cardinay. With CLA Accountants, formerly Galena. He is the tax man, and there's nobody better. So I want to, again, thank my sponsors, Five Star Bank, Audi of Rockland. You need a new car, come see me. I'll hook you up at Audi Rockland. But next week, it's going to be another great show. We're going to have Trish Rodriguez, who oversees Kaiser Hospital Group in South Sacramento and is a leader at the Sac Metro Chamber of Commerce. And she'll be joined by investor John Coonhart, who built the first $100 million venture capital fund right here in Sacramento. When I return, I will have some closing thoughts about pain, about patriotism, and about purpose. This is Entrepreneurs Unlimited, and we are on Facebook Live, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to Entrepreneurs Unlimited with Mark Haney.
You know, today we've been paying respect to the pain and the sacrifice of real men. But what about us? What kind of pain do you like? I mean, these guys have sacrificed and their families have sacrificed. I mean, but am I right about this? Without pain, right, there's no gain, right? There, success does not happen easily. It starts, you gotta know how success is earned, and it's, isn't it through a bit of pain and a bit of sacrifice? I mean, we have the freedom to choose what kind of pain we want because of the men that and the women that have sacrificed for our freedom. I mean, we need more men like Greg Van Dusen. We need more men like Greg's Uncle Jim. And you know what? We need more men like Lenny Kovar. These guys motivate me, right? Because what motivate? I mean, if that doesn't motivate you by hearing what other people have done for us, I don't. Maybe it sounds you're un-American. If you're not motivated by these guys, I just can't believe it, and I can't really compare. I always think, and I don't know about you, I always think, well, what can I do? What can I do to do my part? And I don't know if you like that or not, but I'm not going to be a war hero. I can't compare myself to a war hero. I can only compare myself to the guy that I see when I look in the mirror in the morning. And, you know, I got to think about what can I do and what's important to me. And, you know, I don't know if you like this, but what can I do to help my family? What can I do for my friends and my community? How can I make these guys proud? So, you know what? I think about pain is the father of opportunity, right? So many of us think, well, where's my opportunity? How come I can't have all this success in my life? Well, if you put pain toward something that's important to you, opportunity just magically appears. And I think there's so many of us that we forget about that. We sort of expect opportunity to happen automatically, almost like we're entitled to some kind of opportunity. But it really takes some pain and some sacrifice in order to have that opportunity magically appear. And it's when you seize that opportunity that's when winning happens. Winning doesn't happen by accident. Winning happens when you put some pain forth, right? And you realize that, hey, maybe I've got some opportunity. And then that's when the winning has the possibility of even occurring. So, I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. You could be an employee. You could be an employer. You could be a student on their way up. A guy out there trying to make the first string on the football squad. It doesn't matter. It takes a little bit of pain, my friend. You got to get yourself uncomfortable. That's when all the magic happens. Take sacrifices, my friend. There's no guarantees. Seize that opportunity today. Never above you. Never below you. I'm always by your side.